And so we are coming together here every week in the KPOO studio to celebrate Prison Focus, but also to discuss, to debate, and finally hope to dismantle America's love affair with its prison systems. Yes, and today we are fortunate to have with us somebody or some people with a real understanding of what the prison systems is doing, not only to our inmates there, but also to those of us who call ourselves the taxpayers. And it's really a time for us to think, where are we throwing our money on? Yes, and we are fortunate to have with us in the studio an author of a very, very interesting book. And the book is called, Is William Martinez Not Our Brother? Yes, and the cover on there is drawn by Ronald Ron. And it's an indication of the overcrowdedness of our prison system. And in the studio, I have Emily Harris and the writer of this book, Buzz Alexander. Emily, I want to welcome you to the station. I know you have been on KPOO before talking about prison issues, but welcome and thanks for taking the Comrade through the Bay Area.
Great, thank you for having us.
And then I want to welcome Buzz officially to our program. It's really an honor and pleasure for us to have you here, and thank you so much for taking some of your valuable time to come and visit us and talk to our listeners about specifically about this book and about inmates, about programs that can assist in rehabilitation, and also about your analysis of the prison industrial complex.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here too.
Thank you, Buzz. Yeah, and as I said, it was really difficult for me to draft the questions because I couldn't figure out which is the most important component here. Is it the organization that we use to bridge the gap and to bring more focus to our overcrowded prisons? Or is it the inmates that is so valuable and that is loved ones or families outside, brothers and sisters, you know? Or is it the whole system of incarceration where our focus would be there and break it down and get more understanding of it? But I have some questions for you. First of all, I want to ask you, just tell us a little bit about yourself. I know you're a professor that has just in 2005 won the Carnegie National Professor of the Year Award in 2005. But also you have another beautiful name, Arthur Thurnau. Am I pronouncing it right?
Thurnau. Oh, yes.
Thurnau.
Yes,
uh-huh. And then also you on the book, you call yourself Buzz Alexander. Just briefly tell us a little bit about that. Because I was figuring, is Buzz a more militant person than Professor, or is it the same person?
it's a story. I'll tell it because then people will know and they won't ask me anymore. Maybe so. I was given the name before I was born.
Okay.
My older sister, who is 2.5 years older than me, and she's here in San Francisco, was having read a book to her about five little kittens, mm-hmm. And their names were Suzz, Fuzz, Buzz, Does, and Agamemnon. And she was asked if she wanted a little brother, and she said no, she wanted a Buzz. If she'd said Agamemnon, we wouldn't be in this room today. I don't know what would have happened to me.
Okay.
But I've had Buzz all my life. That's my name.
Yeah, and then for a person like you, being in English, in literature, what has driven you towards working in or struggling against the incarceration in the U.S.?
Well, it actually happened, in a way, it happened by accident. I was in the anti-war movement. I've been an activist in a number of ways for a long time. And what actually happened is in 1971, after the anti-war movement, everybody who'd been in the movement had to decide whether they'd been serious about mm-hmm. it and had to decide whether it was going to affect the rest of their life and their careers and so on. And I made that decision that, of course, it had to. And so gradually I moved towards the prison work. I did guerrilla theater for a while, did video projects with people in the labor movement. And what happened is I was teaching a guerrilla theater course, and there were two women who were incarcerated. Excuse me. And they were lifers in a women's prison about an hour and a half from us. And they wanted to take the course because they were enrolled at the University of Michigan through a dean who was very liberal and progressive, enabled them to do that. And I said yes. And I said, I think others might have said no, or they might have just sent educational materials out to them. But I said yes because of my past. I sort of knew that this was something I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And so myself and the student who was carrying the materials and another student went out there every week. And we did theater exercises, and it was kind of a crash course in learning about prison and incarceration.
Yeah, you talk in your book about your travels abroad as well, and then coming back and getting involved. And you also talk about looking at a name that can include all the kind of things that you do. And in the end, you and some of your colleagues came up with the name Prison Creative Arts Project. Now, this book that I have in my hand is William Martinez, Not Our Brother. And then it has a little subtitle that says 20 Years of Prison Creative Arts Project. So I assume that the organization was formed in 1990 and it's still going strong. So when I look at the book, then I want to ask you a little bit about William Martinez, being from Oakland and you down there in Michigan.
Yes. Well, what happened is that Robert Moses, the civil rights activist, came to the University of Michigan, and he gave a talk. And in the middle of the talk, he said, "The problem with America is that we do not think of other people's children as our own." Mm-hmm. And so my students were there. Some of them were there, and they heard him say that. And then when we were showing the California Prison Focus, a film about what had happened at Corcoran Prison, they began to ask us about William Martinez. They said, "Is he our brother?" was the question that got developed. And Martinez was grew up in Oakland. I don't know his whole history. I was able to research a little bit. And when he grew up, he ended up joining a gang, Nuestra Familia, and at the Corcoran SHU, Security Housing Unit, he was put into the yard with somebody from La Amy, from L.A.
The opposing gang.
Opposing gang. Pedro Lomilli was his name. And what actually was happening was that the guards were betting. Corrections officers were betting on who would
win the fight.
And what happened with him is that he won the fight, which they put the two in the yard at the same time, knowing that they would fight. And he won the fight and then was walking away, and they shot him in the back with one of these bullets that explodes inside of you so it doesn't hit other people afterwards and so on. And that's basically the story. So this is somebody who grew up, and we don't know a lot about his background. Assume he grew up in a difficult part of Oakland, but we don't know what kind of poverty. His family family later tried to sue, so the family was together and tried to get money out of the department after what happened. So it might have been a very stable, a loving family, and he ended up in a gang. Really don't know about that. But the question is, of the book, and it's a really honest question, is somebody who grew up in these circumstances ended up doing some kind of violence, or at least in prison did some kind of violence because that's why he was in the SHU, is he a relative of ours? Is he is he our brother? And one of the things I talk about in the book is about a friend of mine, Nate Jones, who grew up in East Detroit, grew up in poverty, was sexually abused by a cousin and beaten terribly by his father and so on, ended up running away, juvenile facility, got beaten up in a army barracks when he was in the army. Somebody tried to stab his eyes out, a couple of white guys. And Nate emerged and became very creative. He did some therapy in the prison, and he came out, and he came to the University of Michigan. He actually went out to some of the sites we work when he was in my courses, got a social work degree, and then crashed and came back from crashing and crashed and came back from crashing and so on and eventually died of cancer of the esophagus and had a couple of daughters. And a lot of us worked around that. So my honest discussion of that is that he called me his best friend. But in some ways I wasn't able to be that. And sometimes I was negligent because a lot of things were going on with me. There's a poem in the book called Back Off in which I'm very autobiographical about that.
And I saw the poem about water. That's a brilliant one too.
Thank you.
I think that, you know, yes, we're talking here to Buzz Alexander, who's the author of this book, is William Martinez, not our brother. What I did, I immediately jumped into the appendix of the book because I could see that you have two mission statements, and one of them, I don't know, it was actually the pressure that was from Mr. Dan Bolden. I want you to tell me a little bit about him. And then also the second mission statement ratified by the full membership that includes also core values, but it excludes the working closely with each facility to achieve certain things, you know? I see those ones are excluded.
That's
just enlighten
right.
us a little bit on the two mission statements.
Yes, the I was summoned to Lansing to meet with Dan Bolden. Basically what we've
done... Who's the deputy director of the prison?
Deputy director of the Department of Corrections.
Okay.
And what we've done is that we had stayed very under the radar. We never sent questions or anything for approval up to the central administration. We just worked in each prison. And that turns out to have been very smart because by the time he summoned me, we were pretty established. And he actually liked the art show that we did. So that was... But he didn't like the theater workshops. So he called me up there, and basically what he said was that what you have to do is send me a mission statement, and also each of your plays, you need to send them to me so I can see if they're okay. And so that was going to be a system of censorship, and of course I had no choice. You know, if I said no, we would have had no place. So we had to deal with that. And so I sent him the official mission statement. In the meantime, one of our workshops had, they had created a scenario where somebody who was trying to get out of the gang agreed to do one final deal, a street deal. And a policeman ended up being wounded. So the warden got a hold of that, and she was calling, we found out later, she was calling around to various wardens and probably called Bolden, and she said they're killing policemen in their plays. And corrections officers are thought of as policemen, so in fact it was wrong for us to be doing that. That should not have happened, though we weren't killing him. He was wounded and so on, but still it was an issue. And so at that point, Bolden closed us down and didn't speak to me. I made numerous phone calls, and he wouldn't get back to me. And finally, what happened was we had the university intervene, and they wrote him a couple messages, and a state senator wrote him a message. And that day, he reversed himself and allowed us to operate again, though we eliminated our dance workshops. And we had a beautiful dance workshop at the women's prison.
Because I also noted in your book the consistency of keeping track with the language that we use inside the place, and also, you know, have a commitment of understanding and also a commitment of expectation to those participants that participate. You want to talk a little bit about the difference between the commitment and understanding and the commitment of expectation?
Yeah, because there is a chapter in which I try to figure out how you handle that. What we have to do if we're going to work inside is we have to obey all of the rules and regulations. We have to be, and so when we train our members, we tell them that you're not going to take any notes out. You're not going to say anything inappropriate. You're not going to be hugging the prisoners and so on. And we respect that. That's for security. Everybody in the prison needs to be safe, including the people we're working with,
exactly.
including the corrections staff, everybody. So we agree with that. The problem is that we come in with we're creative, we're flamboyant, we're dressed in colorful colors, and when the prisoners leave the workshops, they are usually exuberant, excited, happy. Talkative. In the workshops, they take risks with mm-hmm. the characters they create mm-hmm. or with the poems they read, with the art that they do and so on. And so that's for some of the correctional staff, that's a problem. Mm-hmm. It's a contradiction. They want to keep everything under wraps.
Keep people unhappy in darkness.
Yes. Yeah. And so when they get angry or they eliminate one of us or say you can't do something, then if it's really serious, then what I have to do, and some of my staff do this as well, I have to go in and have a meeting with the warden or with the deputy warden.
I know you did that on one Sunday to save a play that is coming up, a practice that is coming up the next Monday. In the book you're talking
about. Oh, right,
about.
Yeah. Yeah,
going there.
Plus, it's probably been on many Sundays to meet with lots of people.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Do you want to add in on this, Emily?
Yeah. Well, I think also one thing to note is that sometimes I think the biggest advocates for the work inside actually are the staff who get to witness mm-hmm. and see the creative work and can be the biggest allies in supporting us and keeping us there and making sure that we get a full room of people getting to come and that the men or women or youth that we're working with get to have the workshops. And so it can be sort of a mixed experience in terms of being there.
So the plays that you guys perform is actually designed to have an effect on the audience, right? But tell us a little bit, how does it affect the actors themselves?
Affect who?
The actors, the
actors
that is acting out the
Yeah, place, I can actually talk about both, and I can tell you about one play. But what happens for the actors is that they come into a space that to some degree becomes a safe space for them. There's a quotation that I always give, and it's in the epigraph for one of the plays. There was a man named Hollis L. Mm-hmm. who told us once that when he comes into the workshop, he says, "I'm like this," and he clenches his fist. And then he says, he says, "When I'm in the yard, I'm like this," and he clenches his fist, and he says, "In the workshop, I'm like this," and he opens a tiny space between his thumb and forefinger, and then he says, "When I go back into the yard, I'm like this again," and he clenches his fist. For me, that's always been brilliant, because I know when he goes back into the yard, he still has inside of him a little bit of this, even though he's putting up the front that he needs to put up. And in some ways it's modest about what the workshop can do, but it feels appropriate because their life really is very hard in the prison. So uh-huh. And the workshop becomes a resource. What happens is that they work together to create a play. All of the plays are original, so they have a process of collaborating. We interview each of the characters, and so the play develops through character interviews, because I would have Emily get up and she would say some things about her character, and then we would ask her really tough questions and ask her why she was hurting her friend, and she would have to answer that, and then her friend, who's also in the play, would know what she was going to say to Emily the next time we did
Emily
a scene and so on, and they get to perform in front of their peers at the women's prison. We did four performances, and we had 400 women come to see the play over those times, and they become known in the prison as actors. They have a reputation; people call them by their actor's name, and the same for the writers, and the same for the artist. Mm-hmm. It gives them prestige. It gives them, the common word is something like self-esteem, but basically they have a chance to grow, and our sense is that with all of the challenges that they're going to have when they come out, this workshop may not make any difference for them, But it does mean that if they're going home to parent, they're because they have a better sense of themselves and they have a talent and so on. That
and they feel they make a contribution to the betterment of society.
Yeah, and to their own family and so on. It doesn't always happen. I mean, a lot of things happen when you're back on the street. There are temptations and you can't get a job and you get frustrated and angry and so on. But at least it gives something that maybe they can grasp on, they can hold on to, you know, when they go home. The plays are often, they're almost always very funny, but they're also very powerful because at least at our best, we try to ground them in something. And we did a play recently called Within the Sisters Within. And it was a play in which we decided somehow that we were all going to talk about forgiveness. And this meant forgiving the father or the mother who had abused you, or not forgiving them, because we were very honest about this. And there was one of the women whose baby had, because she was addicted to various drugs, her baby was born with drugs, and the baby was taken away from her. And she was wondering if she would ever see her child, who's now maybe 6 or 7, and if she could ask her child for forgiveness, and would her child forgive her? And then the third element was trying to forgive oneself.
That's so important, Buzz. When the lifers appear in front of the parole board, you know, we always wonder where's the forgiveness, you know, from the victim side and then also from the side of the inmate. Buzz, I had so many questions for you. It was even impossible for me to number it number one, number two. So I just made bullet points, you know.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, we are talking here to Buzz Alexander with a very, very powerful book, Is William Martinez Not Our Brother? And talking about 20 years of prison creative arts and then the project that spearhead all of this. Yes, and we're back here with Buzz Alexander. And I wanted to ask you, Buzz, about the history of incarceration in the U.S., you know, and then also explaining to us how capitalism can produce so-called social junk and social dynamite, you know, that can be definitely influencing our communities and the society that we live in.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I want to indicate that my sources for the analysis come from two really remarkable books. One is Christian Parenti's a book on called Lockdown America, and the other is Mark Maurer's Race to Incarcerate. And if you put those two books together, and you can also use many other texts, you begin to get to an economic analysis of mass incarceration. Basically, the analysis is that, and this most of this comes from Parenti at the start, is that when Ronald Reagan came into the presidency, he and some others engineered a artificial recession. And I remember that in Ann Arbor, what we saw, and we saw it everywhere, was suddenly there were hundreds of homeless people. Because they had been thrown out of work, and so people were picking through garbage, they were begging. It was very, very dramatic. It happened very suddenly. I didn't know where it had come from or what had happened, because I didn't have any analysis or understanding at that time. And then what followed from that, and this is the social junk and social dynamite, and this is Parenti's observation, and he's quoting somebody, and I forget who it is, but he's citing somebody. And he says that social junk are people you don't really need to worry about. They're drifters, they're homeless, they're not going to be agitators. They're going to accept what they get, and they're going to die young and be hungry and all of that. But social dynamite are the people who are not going to do that, and they've been thrown out of work, and they're going to suddenly think about what's happening to them. And you may have spontaneous riots, which are very damaging and not really intelligent politically, but you could have those riots, or you might actually have people who begin to organize and think. I mean, there was a group in Pittsburgh called the Mon Valley Unemployed Committee, and these were people who'd come out of universities and entered the steel mills and so on, and when they got thrown out of work, they began to organize, and that would be the other kind of response.
You also mentioned the Black Panther Party in Oakland, you know, coming from the social dynamite.
That's exactly right.
I want to you to latch on to the question of walls, because you are explaining brilliantly how the incarcerating walls are actually made out of many materials.
Yes. Let me go back just a little bit first to continue the analysis, because what happened was when you have all of these people thrown out on the streets, you need to put them somewhere.
Exactly.
And that's when we began to build the prisons. And in and at one point, we were building a prison a week in this country. Mm-hmm. And then we began to create, using scare tactics and fear and so on, we began to create laws that gave the longest sentences in the world. Mm-hmm. So a young African-American school dropout in all of our major cities ends up being in prison for a long, long time, which means they're taken out of the normal life stages that other people have. You know, they don't get married, they don't stay in school, they don't get a job, and then they come home 20 years later, and they're not really marriageable because most of them, because of what's happened in prison. From others are, of course, terrific because of the growth they have in prison. And they're unemployable. They can't get jobs and so on, especially in this economy. So they've essentially probably from birth been taken out of the economy until they die. And so it is about work. It's about jobs. It's about denying people work. It's about denying people nourishment, denying their children nourishment, and so on. So that's the analysis. And Maurer is also very, very good on telling you what this is about.
Mm-hmm. And the walls that you are talking about?
Yeah. I mean, there are a couple passages in the book in which I talk about what the walls are made of. And I talk about what the walls are made of for kids in the schools in Detroit, for kids in the juvenile facilities, and for people in the prisons. And the walls are essentially made out of the environment. So when somebody gets arrested, for instance, a youth gets arrested, his environment is the police car, the noisy jail that he's in because nobody's putting him on bail, the moment in the court when, because he's African-American or because he's poor, gets sentenced to a longer sentence than anybody would. It's the moment in which he was denied drug rehabilitation resources, whereas other more affluent kids get those resources and so on. And that's all, those are walls. There's a woman named Beth Ritchie who talks about the accumulation of insults to the soul. I think that's her phrase. And what she basically means is that again and again and again and again, you are humiliated, you're abused, you're hit, you're denied resources, and those are insults to your spirit and to your soul. And she says there's a moment, and I think the example she gives, there's a moment in which a youth in New York City jumps over the turnstile, because he starts offending in that small way, and then he gets caught, and then he's on his way to prison, and that's the moment in which he cracks because the insults have been so much. And I think that's an incredibly powerful way of looking at it. And then there's another section about the walls in which I talk about those of us who go into the prisons, the walls that we have. And our danger is that we will become numb to what we've learned about social justice, that we will turn off, we will be indifferent to what's happening to other people. And we're endangered then as well because of the walls that we're given. And so that means on both sides there are walls. And what I say is that in the workshops, because of the way we work, those walls become broken down.
Buzz, I also want to ask you about Emily can jump in here, about how the student performance and the progress on university is linked to this program. And then also, how did the PACP influence the careers of some of your students, and whether they are still involved in the social justice struggles?
Well, one thing that I think is worth noting about the Prison Creative Arts Project and bringing in students from the university to work in prisons and youth facilities and in Detroit high schools is a lot of that experience for students is this, what Buzz was just talking about, this crossing over of the crossing through the walls and mm-hmm. that exist, and actually challenging a lot of the things that we've been taught about who is violent or who's in prison. And for me as a student who went through that experience, really challenged all sorts of stereotypes that I had been given about people in prison, and allowed me to collaborate with people, to be creative, to laugh, and to have one of the most real experiences that I experienced while I was in college was actually the spaces that I shared in a collaborative way with people who were very different than me from my background and very different from a lot of the students who come from the university. So it's this breaking down of this alienation of communities and a space for people to share and collaborate and to grow together. Mm-hmm. And I think for a lot of my experience, for a lot of people who've been through the Prison Creative Arts Project, it's really a space for a political development.
Because sorry to cut you there, Emily, I want you to continue. Because the idea that I got from this book, too, is that with regard to the students, is that teaching the students that before you are a student of a university, you're first part of a particular community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that the I think for me, I had never been asked to look at really hard social issues before getting into the Prison Creative Arts Project. Maybe sometimes, but it was a place where I really had to like look at the world and ask myself, "What do I want?" or "What are we doing to people, and why? And what is this about?" And also gave me a space to feel like I had a responsibility because of what I'd seen or the people that I'd met inside to respond to the human rights violations or to the isolation of individuals, the stealing people from our communities, and really had to sort of say like, okay, I know that this is happening. I'm seeing it. And now who am I going to be to respond and participate in whatever small way that I can to changing that? And I think that that's not an experience I have alone. I think a lot of the people who've been involved with the Prison Creative Arts Project really feel really deeply about what's happening in our schools, in our neighborhoods, in our prisons, and want to respond and are doing that.
Okay.
Yeah, they're now about, we're getting close to 200 former members of the Prison Creative Arts Project, and they get a newsletter that I write twice a year. And we've actually gathered a number of times, and we had a gathering two springs ago in Michigan. There were about 30 of us who came. And we tried to define what it was that that we had in common as PCAP associates. And one of the things we said, we were drawing upon a book by Paulo Freire, Pedagogy of the Oppressed. Mm-hmm. And we identified that what he says is that you must name the world. That means you must say what's really going on. And we decided that that's one of the things that we tried to do. And it's not always easy to name the world, and it's not always easy to give a good analysis, and not always easy to say things for what they are. But we thought that was something that we wanted to do, and we tried to do, and we tried to be honest and name things. And then the other things, and I finished the book with this when I talk about the associates, is that they understand, and they're like everybody else. They're frail, and they've got troubled lives, and they're trying to work things out. And I mean, they're no different from anybody else. But one of the things that, when they're able, they try to do is they try to understand that they're like a Sisyphus, the figure that would push this the boulder all the way up to the top of the hill, and mm-hmm. then it would roll down again, and he would come back down, and he would push it up again, which means basically is you understand the odds against you, and what's happening economically to people and so on, but you figure you need to be part of the answer to that, and pushing the boulder up the hill means that something's going to happen for the people you're connected with. Something's going to happen for you. And at least you've made the choice that Emily's talking about, which is you're going to be that kind of person in the world. And I think that's what the associates have.
That's so important for a university to play that role, and for us then to create some space for those things to happen. On the line, I also have Reverend Odeye. Reverend, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
And Reverend is from the area of Sacramento. Reverend, we are discussing here with Bas Alexander. A book is William Martes, Not Our Brother, 20 years of Prison Creative Arts Project. So before I ask you, Buzz, about the next step of your tour here in the Bay Area, I just want to come to Reverend Odeye quickly, because we went to a parole board hearing, and here on Prison Focus, we always celebrate the release of our inmates, especially lifers, you know, of which you're talking about in your book extensively too. And then this week, my co-host Charles Carbone, he made really history of having five people appearing in front of the parole board hearing, and four of those people have been released. And me and Reverend Odeye, who's working in Sacramento area and have organization surrounding that, were attending this parole board hearing. So I want to know from Reverend his opinions, and then I'll come back to you in terms of the rest of your program. Reverend, hello?
Yes.
Can you tell the listeners a little bit about what transpired over there by the parole board and how you saw that?
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me on the show.
Okay.
It was, I'm still feeling the wonder of it. The parole board hearings are very stressful for people. The families, when you come in and you hear the, how families are being destroyed. I mean, you know the victims' families who have problems, but also the people who have been accused of the crime or the perpetrators, also their families also suffer greatly.
Mm-hmm.
And what we saw there were several people's families came in, and their loved ones have been incarcerated for at least, you know, I think the lowest one was 16 years. The rest of them were like mostly 20 years or more. And you could just see how these people had grown up without their fathers or grown up without their brother. And the effect, the really horrifying effect that it's had on them and their family, how these families are really trying to keep it together, the psychological damage that it's done to them, financial damage that it does to them, and it's really hard. It's really horrible when you sit there trying to sit through all this. You can't help but cry most of the time.
Yeah, Reverend, what I liked about your input was that when you came to the podium, you were telling the parole board hearing, I know that you heard many of these things before, but I want you to wake up and pay attention. And they actually set up and paid attention.
Yeah, I was going to get into that. Is that I noticed that through a lot of the hearings, there were a couple people that would listen and a couple times. There were a few of the commissioners who seemed to be on it all the time. They seemed to be aware. Actually, there's only two of them that seem to have stayed on aware of what was going on. And so when I was talking with them, I could see that. And one of the things I wanted to make sure was that they understood that, we understand where things are coming from. We understand that they get jaded listening to all these people talk. And a lot of people repeat the same things over and over because, I mean, basically, that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with the same situation over and over again. People trying to get loved ones free. And, you know, these people are used to hearing this. So, you know, unless it's something that particularly catches their attention, you know, we know that they're not likely to move forward.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things, when I saw them, you know, I came up and talked to them, and they were starting, you know, I saw some of them starting to pay attention, and then a couple of them were starting to go off to the side, and that was the reason why I just said, well, hey, listen, you know, you guys need to stop, pay attention to what we're talking about. And I noticed that they did. They actually, you know, at that point, you know, being called to task, they sat up and started paying attention to what we were saying.
Reverend, We are definitely here on Prison Focus in the KPOO studio. 89.5 is our dial. We definitely celebrate the release of all those lifers, and then we hope that more people could be released soon come. So when we talk about Naftali, because a lot of the listeners here knows that we were following Mr. Simmons. Naftali was went in when he was just 18 years and returning now after 20 years. So let's just talk a little bit about the importance of integrating the person and doing some work in our communities for integrating the people. How will we integrate Naftali in your movement, for instance?
Well, I know Naftali and I have, you know, we've spoken for a long time, and I'm excited about him getting out because he is going to, Naftali is a very spiritual person, and to my mind, he's already become a priest, and when he comes out, he will take his place as one of our priests within our order.
Mm-hmm.
And what we intend to do is through that and getting him back involved in various parts of community life, especially within the Rastafari community, which is where his focus really is,
mm-hmm.
and trying to get him to, and his other focus of his is dealing with youth, is one of the things he wants to do when he gets out.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll be working towards that end, working with him towards that, and you know, giving him that support there. One of the things that was a problem, and I noticed when we talk with a lot of people, when we talk about the release of all the prisoners that the federal government has
mm-hmm.
demanded that California do,
mm-hmm.
and people, there's really very little support system out here for these people.
Mm-hmm. Reverend, I definitely want to talk to you more about your work. I just want to let you know that this coming Sunday, not this Sunday, the next Sunday, because Naftali and them will be released on Tuesday. So
okay.
this following Sunday, which is the 31st of October, we'll definitely have a big celebration for his release and bring all the relevant role players in his life together. So, Reverend, thank you so much for your time. And we will definitely talk again next week. Yes, so we are still talking here to Buzz Alexander, and his book is William Martinez, Not Our Brother. So, Buzz, I want to ask you, while you are visiting the Bay Area, where can people come and listen to you? What is your next move from here? Are you going to visit one of the prisons here? And then more important, how can people get hold of your book?
Yes. Well, yesterday, Emily and I actually, with another PCAP associate, were at the San Francisco jail and had a great occasion with the these are people in the psych ward. And, well, it was wonderful. You know, it felt very comfortable. And we're going this afternoon, Emily and Pete Wywoody and me to San Quentin. We're going to be in an English class there, talking with people and reading and talking about writing and so on. And I'm going to a similar place in Baltimore when I go there. So we're trying to go inside and give readings and interact with people around the book and around the issues.
Okay. So how can people get hold of the book?
Well, there are two ways. One is you can just go to Amazon.com
mm-hmm.
and just type in Buzz Alexander, and it'll come up. And I think the price is it's around $25, which mm-hmm. is different from the $35 that I think is the price if you
buy it from modern books.
Buy it from a bookstore mm-hmm. and so on. So that's a good place to go. But I also encourage people to actually put in another $10 and go to the bookstores, because the bookstores are hurting
mm-hmm.
Right now. There's,
so we will find the book in the Bay Area on the bookstores.
Should be in the bookstores mm-hmm. now, yes.
We did a reading at Green Arcade on Tuesday night, and we know they've got copies of the book, and we'll are happy to order
So
more.
Give us the address of Green Arcade
Green
again,
Arcade
Emily.
Green Arcade is on Market and... I'm not sure exactly the address, like 1680 maybe?
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And then also, if anybody's interested in learning more about the Prison Creative Arts Project, and there's links to getting the book there, they can visit prisonarts.org, and there's more about all of the work and art from the annual exhibition of art by Michigan prisoners and other testimonies about the work and ways to get in touch if people are interested.
We'll also tell people about our linkage project, which is where we work with prisoners who have come home and link them up with community arts mentors and so on. So when I heard Father O'Day speak, I was reminded of that because it's very important to work with people who come home, and we definitely do that as well. And definitely, it was inspiring to hear what he had to say.
So we will definitely let's on with Emily, since he's in the Bay Area, to talk to us more about that kind of organization and how to have these arts projects. You know, there is so many other questions that I have regarding the book, but the only thing that I can say to people out there is go out and get a copy of this book, because everything is in that book, from the A to the Z of the prison industrial complex and also how to organize against it. Buzz, thank you so much for your time and your willingness to come and share with the listeners here. We wish you all luck with your travels and especially your visit to St. Quentin. And those brethren in St. Quentin, look out, this man, Buzz Alexander, is going to cause a buzz in your area soon.
And thanks again for having us.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks so much. It's the questions were great, and they provoked us to give, hopefully good answers.